have nothing to disclose and no off-label drugs to discuss. And I'd first like to recognize someone who has taught me a lot about life, and that's my mom, who just walked in, and Annette Donahue, whose presence here is a great blessing to me, and she came along for the trip. I want to start with a reading from a physician writer. This was advice to medical students on their first day. Turn back now if you are not prepared and resigned to devote your lives to the contemplation of pain, suffering, and squalor. Your outlook on life will have none of the deception that is the unconscious support of the layman. To you, all life will appear in transit. You will see the pull of the grave that never lets up for one moment, draw down the cheeks and corners of the mouth, and bend the back until you behold beauty abashed and life itself caricatured in the spectacle of the living, looking down on the sod as if to find a grave. So it's not clear how many students just ran for the windows at that point in the doors. But he went on and said, you can never retreat from the world, which is for you a battlefield on which you must engage in a relentless and unceasing war from which you know that you can never emerge victorious. Well, we all will be exposed in some way to illness and to death throughout our lifetimes, either in seeing the deaths of loved ones and friends, our patients if we're practitioners, and obviously, ultimately, ourselves. In fact, Lewis Thomas in The Youngest Science wrote that perhaps all medical students should be exposed to an aerosolized virus at some point in their freshman year to introduce them to the concept of what it's like to be sick and to actually hospitalize them in the ward and make them go through some of the same procedures that their patients ultimately will. And each of us will respond differently to suffering and death, particularly as we think about our own mortality. And so what I want to share with you today are some of the responses that characters and authors have shown in great works of literature. And many of the writers that I'll discuss are physicians, and many of the slides will say physicians' responses to, but this equally applies to nurses, to social workers, to hospice workers, to all of us who work with patients who are dying. We are all in a privileged position. As Somerset Maugham, another physician, wrote in Of Human Bondage, doctors see human nature taken by surprise, the mask of custom torn off rudely, showing the soul all raw. Now, over the last century, there have been many changes in death and dying. At the beginning of the 20th century, most people died at home. There was a transition to death in the hospital, and now a transition back to more people dying at home. And there's an increased openness and decreased stigmatization about discussions regarding death and an awareness of the emotional, social, economic, and cultural factors that go into a good death. There are clinical protocols to achieve a better death, and families are becoming more involved, such as families being in the room during codes, and hospice is a growing movement, and we'll hear more about that later this morning. We've seen improvements in the care of the dying, such as better symptom management in the dying patient, better end-of-life discussions, and more appropriate use of do not resuscitate orders. Improvements in managing conflicts regarding decisions to limit treatment, withdrawing intensive life-sustaining treatment compassionately, and even facing patient requests for physician-assisted suicide. Nevertheless, studies show the need and desire for further training in death and dying and end-of-life care among medical students and trainees. And there is a tremendous need for improvement in areas such as physicians' communication with patients about advanced directives, which is less than ideal. Patients often leave routine advanced directive discussions with serious misconceptions about life-sustaining treatments, and a significant portion of patients misunderstand their options in end-of-life care. Physicians are frequently unaware of their patients' preferences for site of terminal care and their wishes regarding do not resuscitate status, and family members are often troubled by the amount of pain that they perceive their dying loved ones experience in their last days. A little breather, we'll cool down. Why literature? Well, Larry Churchill wrote, death is a non-technical solution problem, a problem of the human condition. It calls less for the mystery of quantifiable, sorry. It calls less for the mystery of quantifiable factors and formal knowledge than for depth of insight, acuity of perception, and skills in communication, namely the sort of expertise which is traditionally associated with literature. So I'm going to just run through some works by authors that report the various reactions that characters have had to death. Much of this will appear out of context since you may not know many of the works. I wish we had more time because then we could have a group discussion regarding what works of literature you may have used in your own teaching or that have influenced you. I certainly welcome comments and even submissions to the website that I manage, which is called publichealthandsocialjustice.org or just phsj.org, which contains over 100 open access PowerPoints, at least some of which are regarding death, and I always welcome contributions to the site. And there is a paper that I published about 10 years ago on this topic that is also available on the site. So this slide shows on the site, the paper's on the site, you don't need to take notes, it's all there. So the first response is just sadness and grief. In The Youngest Science, again by Lewis Thomas, an intern wept while presenting a case at Morbidity and Mortality Conference. And then in William Carlos Williams' Dead Baby, he described a funereal scene in which the corpse, a curiosity, lay surrounded by fresh flowers in a clean-swept home. This apparent order only temporarily conceals the powerful emotions of the mourners. Another response is fear. In physician-writer John Keats's When I Have Fears, he wrote, "When I have fears that I may cease to be before my pen has gleaned my teeming brain, then on the shore of the world I stand alone and think till love and fame to nothingness do sink." In Danse sur le Macabre, William Carlos Williams, another physician, wrote, "Christ, Christ, how could I bear to be separated from this, my boon companion, to be annihilated, to have her annihilated? How can a man live in the face of this daily uncertainty? How can a man not go mad with grief, with apprehension?" And Michel de Montaigne, "It is not death that alarms me, but dying." Another response from Williams is anger. In the poem Death, he wrote, "He's dead, the old bastard. A godforsaken curio, without any breath in it, making love an inside howl of anguish and defeat." Another is simply passive recognition or acceptance. In physician-writer Anton Chekhov's Ward No. 6, the main character, Dr. Andrew Yefimich, comes to accept suffering and death as inextricable, even ennobling aspects of the human condition, and said, "To despise suffering and death would mean to despise one's own life." In Sanatorium, Somerset Maugham describes the tuberculous Mr. Chester, who grows to accept the nurturing companionship of his wife, whom he had alienated out of resentment for the fact that she would live while he must die. At the tale's conclusion, he says, "I don't mind dying anymore. I don't think death's very important, not so important as love." Another is, of course, humor. In The House of God, the exhausted interns use sick humor as a defense mechanism against the tragic and unexplainable deaths they encounter. This serves a protective function, allowing them to laugh at what, when seen in normal rather than grotesque terms, might make them quake or cry. Woody Allen, "I'm not afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens." Or Clarence Darrow, "I never wanted to see anybody die, but there are a few obituary notices I have read with pleasure." Another response is futility. Cardiologist John Stone wrote a poem called Answering the Phone. And worn down by the deaths of neighbors, patients, and friends, he expressed his frustration and feelings of futility when he picks up the receiver and says, "Not hello, but now what? Now what?" Another response is meditative introspection. Montaigne wrote, "To learn philosophy is to learn to die." And Rilke wrote, "Each man bears death within himself, just as a fruit enfolds a stone." In the essay In Praise of Senescence, Richard Seltzer wrote, "One way to confront death is to think about it, to philosophize, and thereby to peel away the fruit, to discover the stone within ourselves." On the other hand, another response is denial and insecurity. Seltzer, in The Exact Location of the Soul, describes a physician who, uncertain of his ability to heal, pretends that there is nothing to fear, that death will not come so long as people depend on his authority. Yet later, after his patients have left, he closets himself in his darkened office, sweating and afraid. Another response is a comfort from belief in an afterlife. Donne, in Death Be Not Proud, wrote, "Death be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou thinkst would thou dost overthrow, die not. Poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me." And I apologize for the mispronunciation or mispunctuation. Again, Donne, "When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language." Well, we don't all believe in an afterlife, and some of us have doubts. Again, Woody Allen, "I don't believe in an afterlife, although I am bringing a change of underwear." Another response is surprise. Again, John Stone in the poem Death. "Death, I have seen come on slowly as rust, sand, or suddenly as when someone leaving a room finds the doorknob come loose in his hand." How much time do I have?
3 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Okay. These are a few other readings that I've used in my teaching over the years. One is called The Gift by Alan Kennedy, which is a brief story of a physician who's duped by his angry wife, who requests continued aggressive care of her moribund husband in order to prolong his suffering. And of course, this raises profound ethical issues about uses of proxies and are they indeed following the patient's wishes. Medicine by Alice Walker, which is a poem on marital devotion and love as palliative medicine. Man is Only a Reed, from Penseus by Blaise Pascal, in which he writes about cognition and awareness of death ennobling man. In the Room Where My Father Died is an essay by Joan Siegel. She writes about death in the context of the modern intensive care unit. Confluence at Life's Extremes by David Silverman is a short tale on the rewards of geriatrics, and for anyone who's considering that career, I highly recommend this piece. Again, they're all referenced in the paper. And then essays by Roger Bone, who is a well-known intensivist who passed away and wrote searchingly and poignantly over the course of about a year in the Annals of Internal Medicine about his process of dying. Well, there's an English proverb that says, "Death always comes too early or too late." But I like to think of what Samuel Johnson said, which is, "It matters not how a man dies, but how he lives." So hopefully the goal of all of us is to follow Mark Twain's advice. "Let us endeavor so to live that when we come to die, even the undertaker will be sorry." So again, this is the reference. It's from the Journal of Palliative Medicine. It's about 10 years old, but the literature hasn't changed that dramatically. And then the slideshows are all on the website, which is this, and that's my contact info. And so anyone who has suggestions or wants to begin a online discussion, please do contact me. And I'll take, do I have a minute for questions?
Yes, please.
Or comments? Yes, sir.
Amazing breadth of cultural diversity in that group and across other cities and other towns in the nation. While I find this very interesting because I like literature and I like to read about death and I'm okay with it and it's my bag, but I do and I present on end-of-life issues, do you see a way that this can be used not only to educate house staff, medical students, and so forth, but also as a way to maybe in a different format access patients and their families throughout a dying process?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful idea. Where I've used these in the past is, as you say, on things like ward rounds. I'll have the students read the story the night before. We'll actually read the poem on ward rounds. I've never actually tried it with patients or their families. I know there are some who have. Albert Hutter was a psychoanalyst at UCLA who was one of my mentors. He was an English professor, and he used literature in his psychotherapy, including with dying patients. And there is some literature surrounding that. But I've never tried it myself, and I think that's an absolutely wonderful idea. I have tried using literature with patients in the setting of a homeless shelter where I worked once, where we read a Doris Lessing story called An Old Woman and Her Cat about a dying homeless woman. And while only half of the discussants who were the homeless patients read the story, there were nurses involved too and a few physicians, and it really opened up a new level of comfort as we talked about the character in the story, and many of the homeless individuals would express their concerns as saying, well, the character feels this, and this, my sense was that really what they were saying was, I feel this, and they were afraid to say that. So I think that's a great idea. Are you scratching or question? Yes, ma'am.
Could you repeat again the title of the book that you used with the homeless?
Oh, it's called An Old Woman and Her Cat by Doris Lessing. And in fact, on the website, there's a whole page of course syllabi that has all my syllabi for literature and medicine courses over the years. And again, everything on the website is open access. Just with appropriate citation, feel free to take any of the PowerPoints, including this one. Use it yourself if you want to use it with students, the general public. That's what it's there for. I have no proprietary interest whatsoever on any of this, and in fact, would like to get the word out.
Great. Thank you very much.